at SchofieldSolarAndHeating.com. 7 o'clock, Thursday Night Talk starts right now. And welcome to Thursday Night Talk here on KHSU. This week, Eric Kirk is our host. We welcome your contributions. Give us a call at 826-4805. If you're out of the area, toll free at 800-640-5911 and to our text line at 492-KHSU.
Thank you, Michael. Well, my guest tonight is Nathaniel McGuigan. Did I say that right?
Yes, you did.
All right. This is part of an ongoing series I've been doing actually on both stations. Some of you out there may know that I do a show on K-Mud down in Redway as well. And I've been trying to figure out what's been happening locally, politically. One of the we've had some great developments for progressives over the past few elections. And this last election, Measure K passed by actually a comfortable margin, although it was pretty scary on election night for those of us who were supporting it. Measure M went down in flames. That would have retained the McKinley statue. The election results in Eureka, and we've been kind of analyzing it. And one of the takes, I have it down to about five or six things that have changed in Humboldt County, but one of the factors that I've really looked at was a powerhouse youth movement. We have a lot of leaders and political people, some of them from the university, and Nathaniel is a student here at HSU, but also elsewhere in the community. There are a lot of young activists. It's an aging community, but there is still a lot of youth here, and some of the activism is just amazing. And I wanted to tap in to Humboldt State. You're actually going to be, I think, the youngest one. Haley was 20. Next to the youngest one that I've interviewed. And so I want to introduce Nathaniel McGuigan. He is a student here. You major in cell?
I'm majoring in cell biology, and I have a minor in business.
Okay, and you are a senior at this point.
Yes.
But you'll be going another semester, but mm-hmm. You'll still be around here for a while and influencing things. And you are very active. You are involved with Mecha. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
And I've always wondered, why is the H small? Do you know?
So the H small is small because the H is a part of the C. And basically, what Mecha stands for is that it stands for Movimiento Estudiantil Chicanal de Islam, Chicano Student Movement of Islam. And the H is a part of the word Chicano, and so we lowercase the H.
That's right, because if it was bigger, everybody would assume it was a separate word.
Yeah, of course.
Got it. Okay. Anyways, you are involved with that, and as well as the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Yes,
I got that right. I didn't want to get those reversed, and I know a little bit of the history of that. We'll get into discussing that. And you were active around Measure K and Measure M, and you've been active in a lot of campaigns locally, correct?
Yeah, I've been involved in a lot of those campaigns, both. During the whole the electoral process, prior to the electoral process, and even after the electoral process, not only with those campaigns, but some other issues that have gone and passed over the years.
And you were raised in San Francisco, right?
Yep.
When did you first start to become what you would call political or politically aware?
So I started to become politically aware when I first started here at HSU, when I first joined Mecha, it wasn't as politically active as it is today, but over time, the story of Mecha here on campus developed to one where it was, an organization that is deeply rooted in political activism on a campus and supporting like other student-based organizations as well as like community-based organizations.
It was on my university. I went to UC Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. It was there. I remember it organized around striking farm workers in Watsonville. It focuses on issues pertaining to the Latino community, but also others. It's pretty broad, and so well, that's always a good thing to tie into. And there is interest here at HSU, right?
Of course. Yeah. We have a lot of members who come to our meetings, as well as like people who come to us for issues that they want to have addressed. And we pretty much address them within a timely manner and try to address them as best we can.
So your political awakening did come in college then. You didn't really start in high school quite.
Not necessarily. I was involved in volunteerism. As a high school student, that's how high school students are. It's usually out of self-interest. When coming to like political activism was more so for community involvement and like getting as well as supporting the community.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you get out of political activism, kind of what you put into it, you find community. For some people, it's kind of almost like church, and that's not saying that is a bad thing. It's people coming together with a common belief and common, you know, and you don't necessarily believe in everything. I'm sure you've had meetings with arguments, but a general philosophy that you share. And that's, yeah. So, well, that's great. And I see you all the time. That's one of the reasons I wanted to, is anytime there's any kind of a political event, you know, it's, you're one of those people. And there are a few others around here, a few that I have to still interview. It's kind of like the Where's Waldo. You'll see them and you will see you at these events. And so I felt wanted to get you in here to talk a little bit about what motivated you and what makes you, let's talk about what is the Party of Socialism and Liberation.
So the Party for Socialism and Liberation is basically a socialist political party that formed in 2004.
Right.
And the whole point of the Party for Socialism and Liberation is to advance the worker struggle through various sectors of society, of the working class, such as we work to advance the worker struggle within teachers' unions, unions in general, immigrant rights, Black Lives Matter, as well as like several other working class sectors within the United States. But we don't only focus on workers' issues here in the United States, but we also focus on other issues like outside of the United States. And here locally, some of the members that we have here, we were working on several of the local issues, from Justice for Josiah. Mm-hmm. We've been involved in like the rule of the McKinley statue, the passage of Measure K, as well as like several other local issues that we have on our plate at the moment.
And did you work on Gloria LaRiva? I know she runs for president sometimes or offers on it. Did you work on her campaign at all?
I did help out a little bit with the campaign up here.
I've worked with her in the past. I enjoy it. My interactions with her, I will tell you, I'm aware of the Party for Socialism and Liberation because it sort of intersects with a past activism of my own. I was in high school actually and had a teacher that sort of inspired me to be a socialist. And what did I do when I was 15 years old? I looked up socialism in the phone book, and who was there but an organization that's kind of defunct now called the Socialist Workers Party. It was the first Trotskyist split off from the Communist Party. And my understanding is the Party for Socialism and Liberation had kind of broken away from Workers' World Party, right? Workers' World Party was started in the 1950s. A gentleman named Marcy, I'm forgetting his first name, but you'll probably be familiar with the literature. And they broke away from the Socialist Workers' Party in a dispute over the Hungarian Revolution and the result there. And I forget who took what side, but some of them believed that this was a genuine workers' revolution against the deformed workers' state of the Soviet Union. And another side believed that it was a CIA-inspired, destabilization attempt. It's possible both were true. Who knows? it's always complicated. But So I became familiar with that. And when I joined the Socialist Workers Party, of course, you learn that there are a lot of different groups like this. But what I found interesting with the Party for Socialism and Liberty, pardon me, Liberation, is that you added the liberation part, because mm-hmm. it's not just a socialist movement, but also a social movement and that deals with other issues that aren't strictly mm-hmm. economic, right?
And exactly. We work to liberate everyone from not only their economic ills, but also some of the social ills. Like we tackle, like some of our members, or like as an organization, we tackle like the patriarchy. And mm-hmm. so like as part of like our organization, we have a women's committee dedicated to the liberation of women within the socialist struggle. And part of that is like organizing within the framework of healthcare rights, reproductive rights, ending domestic violence against women. Mm-hmm. And we also have literature that is written by women for women, which is published in our magazines called Breaking the Chains.
So it's not just strict political organization mm-hmm. to pass a measure or even to organize unions. Mm-hmm. You're organizing along cultural lines. Mm-hmm.
Of course.
And different. Do you have any idea how many members there are, or roughly? It's I know it's gotten bigger since it started.
It's pretty big. As far as I know, we have over 37 branches mm-hmm. within the continental United States.
Right.
However, the membership is usually shifts between like different areas.
Right. Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. it's going to depend on who's there. You were brought into the fold by Kevin Martinez, somebody mm-hmm. who I've worked with, a really brilliant guy, unfortunately not attending HSU anymore, unfortunate for us, mm-hmm. unfortunate for wherever he's at, but I met him, brilliant guy, and I've seen you out on the plaza mm-hmm. in Eureka, and it's been kind of interesting for me to be there, because I kind of moved up here and I actually missed that brand of politics. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, you know, there are different organizations that are kind of like it. None of them are the mm-hmm. same. They all have differences, but I kind of missed it. I didn't, you know, there's sometimes a lot of infighting between them, a lot of turf mm-hmm. wars, and that's kind of the shame, you know, like there's going to be a demonstration and you'll see one organization come in trying mm-hmm. to do one thing, and another organization will come in and they're at each other's throats, and the other people who don't mm-hmm. know aren't in there. It's called sectarianism. I'm mm-hmm. sure that word has come up. We tried to avoid it, but I didn't see it very much up here. I've seen a few mm-hmm. groups up here time and then, but I walked in, I think it was during the Measure K campaign, and there was a table mm-hmm. on the plaza in Eureka, of all places. I mean, that's an indication of kind of, you know, the evolution of politics. Now, not everybody is going to be into that brand of politics. Mm-hmm. You know that. So you work with others. You work yeah. with coalitions of people who think differently and organize differently. But you have your focus mm-hmm. and they have theirs. And
of course. We hope one of our goals is always to, like, unite people. Unite with people and fight with people mm-hmm. for the socialist struggle for liberation by meeting people where they're at. Yes. And that's the whole point of like leading the socialist struggle, because not everyone may be where you are, or maybe essentially politically, but everyone has like a starting point. And so we try to like reach people through their own perspective, seeing like how we can uplift them.
Yeah. In Latin American countries, mm-hmm. I believe it's been called the popular front strategy. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily, everybody doesn't have to be a socialist mm-hmm. like you. They can, but they have similar goals and you mm-hmm. work with them and in coalitions. I think it might have even been the strategy of the Communist Party of the United States mm-hmm. in the 30s as well. But your organization comes from a Trotskyist roots. Do you read Trotsky? Was that?
No, I don't read Trotsky. But as a party and myself specifically, we read a lot of Marx. We read a lot of Lenin, mm-hmm. Engels, as well as like some other socialist philosophers that follow the Marxist-Leninist perspectives.
Do you do it in like discussion group contexts?
Yeah, we do. Sometimes it's like formal, sometimes it's informal, but most of the time we always go deep into like the analysis of like understanding what Karl Marx has said and what Lenin has said in terms of like how to lead the socialist revolution towards and liberation towards a sexual struggle and like how do we accomplish those goals and like do like a series of strategies and tactics.
It can be pretty tough reading. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was in the SWP, I was struggling, and I didn't realize why until later because I was reading The State and Revolution mm-hmm. and Imperialism, the Last Stage of Capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having a really hard time understanding. It was really hard. And then I later learned, one of the other members came and said, can I see that book? And he looked at it. Mm-hmm. And apparently my version had been translated from Russian to Chinese. Mm-hmm. Then into English, and that probably wasn't, you know, from Chinese. And so getting it through two languages mm-hmm. probably wasn't. I probably should have, he traded with mm-hmm. me and said, you probably want one that's just translated straight from Russian. It's already going to be mm-hmm. difficult by itself. And so I was learning the concepts aren't that hard. I mean, mm-hmm. there's some pretty complicated stuff in there, and we were doing it and mm-hmm. There, and it was almost, kind of when I described it, you know, people, I wasn't raised in a Christian context, but they said, well, it sounds like Bible study what you mm-hmm. did, because you'd have discussions in there mm-hmm. With it. And, of course, we were reading Trotsky, too. There was mm-hmm. A book, The Permanent Revolution, mm-hmm. which he wrote. You know, you go from one thing to the next. The Communist Manifesto is pretty straightforward. You know, you mm-hmm, read it.
Of course.
It's pretty easy to understand. But you get into trying to get through Capital, mm-hmm. and that's a slog. Mm-hmm. That's really hard. Have you tried that?
I have not tried that yet. But some of the literature that I have read from Marx and Lenin was specifically Lenin's Imperialism, mm-hmm. State and Revolution,
yeah.
the struggle for self-determination, the Communist Manifesto, and some other forms of literature related to like Lenin.
Yeah, the State and Revolution. Mm-hmm. That's sort of like if someone was to say if I was to read one book by Lenin, mm-hmm. what should it be? That would probably be the one everybody says, because that's where mm-hmm. he kind of lays out his basic philosophy,
mm-hmm.
and particularly in the context of that context, it involved organizing. Mm-hmm. Along cadre levels, almost like a
military exactly.
type of thing, which was especially necessary at a time when Tsarist police were mm-hmm. like trying to hunt him down and kill him, right? So,
it's definitely like a good book to start off with. For me specifically, that was a good book to start off with because it definitely laid out the groundwork for understanding like what Leninism was,
mm-hmm.
And for anyone who's interested in like learning more about socialism, that would definitely be a book to start off with, because it right. actually lays out like strategies and tactics.
Yeah, and actually, I think as somebody told me, if you don't want to read the mm-hmm. whole thing, just read the first three chapters, and it pretty much outlines. Mm-hmm. Although there was he wrote a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, the letters from afar when he was mm-hmm. Sent out to Siberia, wherever he was, and the rest. But but it was a time
mm-hmm.
reflected a time that that you know there was a lot of change happening in a short amount of time there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And he could have wound up dead at any minute, so mm-hmm. he had to get the stuff out because it was pretty intense.
The best thing about Lenin is that he was always writing something, basically analyzing what he was observing in like the social environment of that was occurring not only within Russia but also in like other countries as well, and specifically relaying that analysis to like how the working class within Russia could lead a revolution.
All right, you're listening to KHSU. This is Thursday Night Talk. My name is Eric Kirk. My guest tonight is Nathaniel McGuigan. We're talking Lenin. We're talking, we're going to talk a little bit about Venezuela coming up. If you want to join the conversation, the phone number is 826 826- 4805. Or if you're out of the area and you still have a landline, I don't know how many people still have those, but if you want to save some money, 800-640-5911. That's 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. And if you'd like to, if you're a little shy or just don't want to come on the air and would like a question or comment read over the air, you can send a message into our text number 492-KHSU. That's 492-KHSU. And if you didn't write down all those numbers, you can get them from the site at khsu.org. But Michael will be happy to take calls or read your texts on the air. One of the issues of the day is Venezuela. Now, you talk about mm-hmm. how this pertains to something going on outside our country, but of course it has relevance mm-hmm. in the country too, because it's one of those many cases of history where where the United States involves itself, mm-hmm. whether it's wanted or not. So what is your take on Venezuela, and what are you doing around it?
So my take on Venezuela is that right now, what Maduro is doing, he's continuing the socialist struggle for revolution within the country.
Now, Maduro is the mm-hmm. president of yeah. Venezuela, elected mm-hmm. after Chavez as yeah. part of what's being referred to as the Bolivarian mm-hmm. Revolution.
Yeah, it's basically the Bolivarian Revolution. It's basically the Bolivarian Revolution is essentially like a not only like a socialist struggle for liberation, but it's also like a decolonization movement here within the Americas, mm-hmm. essentially. For anyone who's familiar with the history of Venezuela, or who may not be familiar with the history of Venezuela, is that Venezuela, when it started out as a state, was colonized by the Spanish in 1522, mm-hmm. and underwent a series of like the people in Venezuela, specifically like the slaves as well as like indigenous populations, underwent extreme hardships because like they were forced into slavery to mine for gold.
So 1522, that's about the time Cortez is starting to move into Mexico.
Mm-hmm, right? Exactly.
Yeah, so there's a lot happening at once. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so that was a whole Spaniard colonization of like mm-hmm. the southern Western Hemisphere.
Right.
And so that happened, and a lot of people were being oppressed. And so that was, and it continued, the oppression continued until, under the Spanish, until 1810, when Simón Bolívar came, who was a military and political leader, decided to lead a revolution, a popular revolution amongst the people of Venezuela, to liberate the country from Spanish imperialism.
Right. And what that was in the early 19th century?
1810 to 1830.
Right. So, and it did win at least mm-hmm. Political independence mm-hmm. at that point. And so the name Bolivar is mm-hmm. a inspiration mm-hmm. for the modern revolution. There was there've been different periods of history with mm-hmm. different governments coming in, and
of course,
yeah,
and the United States, ever since like the passage of the Monroe Doctrine, 1823, have repeatedly instituted coups within country to destabilize what has always been occurring within Venezuela.
Right.
In order to help the people.
We have a long history, and, mm-hmm. and sometimes intervention takes different forms. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's subtle economic manipulation, mm-hmm. other times outright invasion, and then mm-hmm. in between is they find some type of reactionary, mm-hmm. some type of thing to support mm-hmm. and make it look like it's from within the country, even though they're supporting. And then so there's concern that that's what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it's like a continuation. Ever since like Hugo Chavez was elected in 1998, there has always been a series of coups as well as like other destabilization efforts to like prevent the accomplishments of that was been occurring under the Bolivarian Revolution from actually like being irreversible, mm-hmm. because like a lot of the people have been benefiting from what has been going on in the country, both under Hugo Chavez and Maduro.
Now, there have been revolutions and changes of power that came about as a result mm-hmm. of armed struggle, Cuba, Nicaragua, mm-hmm. and the like, when regimes changed. But Chavez was actually elected in mm-hmm. in a referendum, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And he passed away at a certain point, right?
Yeah, he passed away in April 2013 due to cancer.
Right. And so Maduro is his successor as mm-hmm. the leader of that movement mm-hmm. at this point. So what is your take now? Of course, you know, this is happening, what, about 3,000-4,000 miles away?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that relevant to here?
So it's important to understand that when within the context of a socialist revolution, of people's uniting for revolutionary change, it's important that your revolution is not unique. Is not essentially unique. It's not essentially in a bubble per se, but it's tied to like other revolutions that are and like people's struggles that are occurring outside within the global spectrum. And so, in a way, your liberation is everyone's liberation. Your cousin who may be in jail may not be liberated, and essentially is not liberated. So that essentially means you're not liberated. And mm-hmm. so, like, everyone's oppression, someone's oppression is everyone's oppression.
So nobody is free and clear from it. If you're
exactly
talking about that, so you're saying it's in everybody's mm-hmm. interest to support every mm-hmm. struggle against
mm-hmm.
that's there. So. And so what are your activities around? I noticed you've organized a few forums.
Yeah, so I've been organizing a few forums to let people know about what's been going on in Venezuela, actually like letting people know what is happening in the country. Mm-hmm. And a part of that is is what is happening internationally and nationally. There is an anti-war movement developing around a war that is being started within Venezuela because with all the possibilities that the United States have been trying to destabilize the country, and especially now with Guaido entering into the picture, one of their last tasks or like last things to implement is war.
Right. Go ahead.
And essentially, if you analyze a lot of what's going on and like within the world, like. Right now, Venezuela has been undergoing a series of economic sanctions, and history has shown that economic sanctions is a pretext to war. And so right now, the United States is driving up its war engine, preparing for war, and right now preparing the masses to to like a demonization campaign around Maduro.
And so it's your feeling that there may mm-hmm. actually be a military invasion at some point mm-hmm. if it's not stopped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If we as the people of the United States do not stop it, if we do not force our government to stop a war on Venezuela, then it is up to us to stop it. Mm. Because history has shown that putting pressure on the government, on your own government, into stopping a war has at times proven successful.
We
like for example
it.
The Vietnam War.
Yes, and other wars. And and also limited it. I mm-hmm. mean, one of the things that so every once in a while somebody in power writes something that mm-hmm. is illuminating. And one of the things that Nixon wrote in what would become the memoirs is he was afraid he had advisors talking about limited nuclear war in Laos mm-hmm. and Cambodia surrounding Vietnam to try mm-hmm. to prevent this stuff going on. And he pretty much said that they were afraid that it would start a civil war in the streets of mm-hmm. the United States based on that. And probably that impression came from the large demonstrations, from mm-hmm. a lot of the stuff that was happening. And so you have to show your opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
A lot of times a war begins with a lot of support. When the Gulf of Tonkin resolution happened,
mm-hmm.
it was like 93% support or something like that. By the time the Vietnam War was over, it was, you know, down to 20s, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, it's actually improved, because I think when the Iraq War started, it was still high and depressing, but mm-hmm. you know, had to be a lot of education done. But it was like 75% as mm-hmm. opposed to 93%. So history is kind of moving on these things. So I think there's going to be a lot of unity around that.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm not going to swear this is your show tonight. I want you to express your points of view. I'm not as enamored with the mm-hmm. Maduro or that particular government, but I'm absolutely against us being involved.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think
exactly.
the United States has any right to be involved in that. I think mm-hmm. that's an issue that has to be resolved by the Venezuelan people by themselves mm-hmm. through their own processes. And so I don't know that we'll actually get to a full-on invasion. There probably mm-hmm. won't be support for that, but it's enough that you're trying to undermine it and make mm-hmm. it chaotic and you know, bring a lot of pain, because mm-hmm. you figure if you can spread the pain around, then they'll blame it on the government. And
yeah, and there's been dozens of protests that have been happening since like January. It first started off with like 20 protests here in the United States, including in cities such as San Francisco. And then on February 23rd, there were a series of 100 protests that were happening, not only here within the United States, but internationally.
Mm-hmm.
And now on February 16th, there's going to be a national march on Washington.
Yeah.
That's going to as not only in Washington, but also in like other countries, to like demand that the United States stop a war, and that as people, as progressives and as revolutionaries, it is our job to like prevent a war from happening.
All right, you're listening to KHSU. This is Thursday Night Talk. My name is Eric Kirk. My guest, Nathaniel McGuigan, student here at HSU, activist in many different issues. We're currently talking about Venezuela. If you want to join in that conversation, that topic, or any other that we've discussed tonight, the phone number is 826-4805. If you're in the area, if you're out of the area, 800-640-5911. That's 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. And if you'd like to text something in, that's 492-KHSU text, KHSU. And I shouldn't just be reading. That's my brain going off into different directions there. And if you missed any of those numbers, you can always go find them at khsu.org. Or where some of you may even be listening to us. So, all right. So you organize with other groups with mm-hmm. Venezuela, and again, it doesn't require that everybody agree on mm-hmm. whether or not, you know, the regime is the perfect regime or mm-hmm. not. Oh, I think we'll take a call. Our first caller is Rick in Garberville. You're on the air.
Hey, interesting show tonight, Eric. I want to kind of bring the conversation a little bit more to the political details that are going on in American politics today. And you know, it's funny. I was listening to the early part of the show and listening to your guest talking about Marx and Lenin and Trotsky or whoever else you guys were bringing up, and I felt this. These little buttons getting pushed in me from all the programming that I have.
Mm-hmm. What programming is that?
Oh, programming generally of being raised in the country in the time of the previous Cold War,
mm-hmm.
and when we were, you know, all taught about, you know, that all of that kind of doctrine was really evil and bad, and we are totally opposed to that in America. And so anyway, I just thought that was an interesting kind of self-awareness.
Were you old enough to experience the McCarthy era, or is that a little bit before your time?
That was before my time. I was certainly hiding under my desk when I was in elementary school.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that whole thing, mm-hmm. and I think that was part of it. So then the other part that I wanted to kind of get to is that, you know, I'm a little concerned that with the Republican Party starting to use the term socialism as a dog whistle to push the buttons like came up in me. I would like to invite you and your guests to talk about socialism in terms, in the more complex terms as we're thinking about it in the United States these days, where recognizing that there are different different schools of socialism. There's the, you know, there's the kind of the classic socialism that I think you've been talking about, and as you know, pertaining to Venezuela and whatnot. And then there's democratic socialism, which some of the countries in Europe have used successfully. And I think that is more along the terms of what the progressive Democrats are suggesting now. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other aspect, which has been ongoing but hasn't been highlighted as such, but that's a corporate socialism that is being applied in this country and has been for some time, which is subsidies, tax breaks, and all to rich corporations, farmers.
There is a saying, I'm forgetting the socialist who said it, but in the United States, we socialize the risk and privatize the profits.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think if you guys could break that down a little bit, or, you know.
All right. So you want to hear him talk about what his idea of socialism is and maybe compare it to what some others. I mean, broadly speaking, socialism is like social ownership over anything. A fire hydrant is an expression mm-hmm. of socialism, but we don't normally think of it in those terms, you know, because it's owned by the municipality. But socialism, more classically in terms of politics, also means about the ownership of the means of production. And be happy to have Nathaniel talk a little bit more about what he views as socialism. And well, Nathaniel?
Yeah, so...
If it's just about Nathaniel's point of view, then if that's the point of the show, then I'd like to suggest that you or other listeners call in with other points
exactly.
of view about what socialism meant, because I think it's really important right now if the progressives are going to defend themselves against the dog whistle. Use of the term socialism, that we educate the public.
Well, let me just, before I turn it over to Nathaniel, let me just suggest something to you. I know the Republicans are trying it. I don't think it's going to work. The reason being is you were able to demonize him. When people like you and my parents were hiding under their desks and there was this fear of you know, the Soviet Union and the end of the world, it was a lot easier to manipulate people, and you had a lot of stuff going on in Eastern Europe and places that was pretty gory. That we had the reports of the Stalin purges and all of that, which came out in the late 1950s. But socialism, one of the things, whether or not you supported Bernie Sanders, one of the things he did is he brought it to the mainstream, and he did it in the context of millennials who experienced a failure of capitalism about a decade ago. So I think they're going to try it. I don't think it's going to have the same effect. It's ever going to get back to when it was in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, where you could tag somebody as a socialist and they would go all out and try to deny it and say, no, not me. I don't think we're ever going to get to that part again. I do think that the right wing is going to try it. But I would like to have people call in and talk about their views of socialism, whether they support it or not. That's exactly it. And maybe before I turn it over to Nathaniel, real quickly, what is your view of it?
Well, I mean, I think you have outlined a number of ways in which, or the let's say the base way in which the term applies. But people don't, because we think of ourselves not as a socialist country, because that's them over there and all the bad things they do. We don't look at the Medicare and, like you say, the fire departments or the highways or whatever else that right. are owned for the common good, developed and maintained for the common good. And that's where I really think that education is really important. And just to put a cap on it so that callers can get in, I'd like to, you know, I really would like to have a discussion more about corporate socialism in this country, because that's the best way to push back mm-hmm. against Republicans, where I think they'll start shutting their mouths sooner if we can highlight the fact of, you know, how you get farmers who are, say, socialism over my dead body, but please give me my corn subsidy check.
All right. I got that point. Thank you very much for your call. Nathaniel, do you want to respond? What is your view of socialism? What do you see it as?
Yeah, so my idea of socialism, and it's pretty much similar to the Party for Socialism and Liberation, is that socialism is basically the ownership of the means of production. And not only the ownership of the means of production, but also a society where the human basic needs are met in terms like housing, healthcare, education, etc. And it's not just something that is applied by the state, but also there is a participatory democratic process that is involved in the whole aspect of socialism. Socialism can only develop in a country if it is supported by the base of society. And so if it's supported by the base of society, then everyone can be involved in a democratic process to build it. And so socialism basically starts from the bottom and moves up to the top, through a continuous flow coming from the bottom.
Let me ask you, have you in your own imagination imagined what that would actually look like in practice?
Yeah, so in fact, I do see it in a lot of places, and I have seen it in some practices. For example, there's several practice applications that socialism can be applied, such as cooperative housing, basic food programs for the poor. So one of the basic food programs for the poor can essentially be Food Not Bombs, which is an organization that is dedicated to feeding the people of the streets, such as the homeless, but also people who can develop their own sense of culture as well as a sense of identity in terms like bringing up about what the applicative process is in terms of socialism. Okay. And so that comes in like political education as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to have Michael read a text from Cameron.
Yes, thanks, Cameron, for texting us at 492-KHSU. It reads, "Hi guys, I haven't read Marx, but if there is an inherent class struggle, doesn't that imply that the struggle is a natural phenomenon? I feel that nature certainly demonstrates that is so."
Well, I think Marx actually argued that. Now, I'm not as much of a Marxist as I used to be. I think it's a bit mechanistic, but he did argue that, yeah, class struggle was part of the dialectic, right? The dialectical mm-hmm. materialism. It's natural for opposites to oppose each other and then something to be synthesized out of that. Mm-hmm. He saw it as historical progress, as a historical process. And it's kind of complicated and esoteric, but I think he would agree that class struggle is something, but that it's, I guess he saw it as a calculus that mm-hmm. we're working our way towards a time when class struggle would become less and less and less until there was a point maybe where there was none, or at least we get close to it. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with your analysis in that, Eric. Class struggle develops when you are in a class society. And through an analysis of understanding class society, at least what we have now in terms of capitalism, has not always been the one we have now. It's gone through a developmental process over the past several thousand years, starting with the first person who was enslaved. Mm-hmm. Most would argue that the first person who had been enslaved was based on gender, so like women who were the first to be enslaved. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it went through like a developmental process through mercantilism and the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah,
and like other things in between.
I think the phases yeah. started where you had your hunter-gatherer.
Yeah.
And then with agriculture, you had the first accumulations of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And that wealth brought power to those who had accumulated it, could employ people to basically defend that wealth. And once they were defending that wealth, why not dominate mm-hmm. around it?
Exactly.
And you had then the slave state kind of developed out of that because we, mm-hmm. you had the surpluses. Then you had slave revolts mm-hmm. and reforms, which led to pre-feudal and feudalism mm-hmm. type situations, which still involve kings and queens mm-hmm. and counts and dukes and the rest, and still involved a slave sort mm-hmm. of slave system, like such as serfdom and the rest. And then out of that, there was the mercantilism, which evolved into mm-hmm. capitalism, which at the time was revolutionary
mm-hmm.
and actually overthrew that system through various means. And mm-hmm.
And there's various stages of capitalism, such right. as imperialism, which is the highest form of capitalism.
But one of the fascinating things about the Communist Manifesto is the first five pages, and this it talks about the stage of history of when it was written. It actually contains, the first five pages contains nothing but praise for capitalism mm-hmm. as a progressive force, as a force that's destroying the last remnants of a slave or serf system, and for everything that it brought about. And he saw it as mm-hmm. a necessary stage before that you had to create the means to develop wealth before you could socialize it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating history, and it actually reminds me very much of Karl Marx was Jewish, and I mm-hmm. think his vision of it was inspired by Jewish millennial prophetic thought, because you have the different phases of history that they talk about through going through time up until the time of the Second Coming. I'm just bringing mm-hmm. that up because when you read the Communist Manifesto, and it reads very Jewish,
mm-hmm.
it's a fascinating account. When the Nazis accuse the Jews of being, you know, at the core of the communist movement, it's not entirely untrue. They're mm-hmm. they're very much an inspirational part in there. And so, yeah, he saw this class struggle as part of a natural system. He just didn't see it as a permanent state mm-hmm. of human nature.
Of course. It's definitely a continuous evolution of where we are in society. Definitely capitalism and the whole class society aspect has its own evolutionary process. It's not natural process, but through the development of socialism, we can like have a true evolutionary process within human society.
Yeah, and he had theories about mm-hmm. it. He talked about alienation, talked about the concept of society and human beings becoming more conscious mm-hmm. of who they are and what they are and what they're doing. And it's whereas capitalism kind of bases itself on the idea of this Newtonian machine, you pump, you feed it with mm-hmm. stuff, and it'll produce the goods as if it was somehow natural, God ordained mm-hmm. or something like that. And he and other socialists, and there are a wide variety of socialists, you know, Fourier and others, envisioned what if we weren't just passive participants in a process. What if we made our own history? And that's what mm-hmm. he said. You know, history of when systems run us instead of humans developing systems.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating thing, and I understand why you're attracted to it.
That's mm-hmm.
why
exactly.
I have that, and I still am. It's kind of like my ex-girlfriend that I still I'm kind of into. You know? I mean, it's and I. There are aspects of it that I think are, ring true. There are also things I think we have to look at as to, like, where did Stalin go wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have thoughts about that?
Where did Stalin go wrong?
Yeah.
I have never had thoughts about that specifically, but I do know that Stalin, at least one fault of his was that he did not include the bottom of society when he was making decisions.
It was very
yeah.
top down. And so You know, and this is these are questions, and I don't want to try to resolve this tonight, but the democratic centralism that Lenin set up, the centralism of it, does you know, once it comes to power, what is the check on that power? What is the check on the party? And that's something to think about, because I don't know that Lenin had thought it quite out through. I don't think he intended for it to become what it did, but he allowed, he made Stalin possible, in my view. I could be wrong on that. It could be other forces entirely, but those are things that we need to discuss. It's becoming farther and farther away. Stalin's purges were in the 1930s, or, you know, 20 years away from it being, you know, ancient history in terms of, you know, a century. But it has happened. When Marxists have come to power, sometimes it's become pretty brutal. How do we address that? How do you prevent that from happening when you come to power? And I'm not saying, you know, that that's what's happening in any particular revolution. I'm just saying that those are things that you will think of throughout your life.
And, of course.
And you will probably come to different conclusions than I have about it, and I'm not, you know, a purist on that. I want to give everybody a last-minute chance if you want to get in, 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911 or 592-KHSU. If you have a text, if anybody else wants to get in their idea of what socialism is, because that is, I won't call it a belief system. It's what inspires you. It's at the core of what you want. You've got all these different issues, but that is what you want. You ultimately want to see a better society. It's not just reacting to this and reacting to evils. You want to move society forward to something better. That's, I mean,
of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, so that's why people can ask, what is socialism to you? And what? And you've already kind of outlined it. But, you know, think about what it looks like. Does the movement need to start to reflect what it's going to look like, do you think?
I think the movement is can be a reflective process, but it can also be like something that is an analytical process as well. Basically, the revolutionary movement is a reflection of the times, and there's always something that will either impede the process, either the government reacts violently towards it, or there's still like a colonial aspect within that aspect that the revolutionary movement is trying to get rid of. And so one of the things that is popularized within a revolutionary movement is the term a revolution within a revolution, in which
that's Trotsky.
Yes, in which women are inherently involved in revolution, and the fact that women have always been leaders within revolutions, and that only they can solve issues that pertain to them, such as sexism, sexual exploitation, rape, etc. And so, like, we can definitely, like, analyze that framework from a woman's perspective.
All right. Well, before I respond, we'll take a call from Blue Lake. Aluka, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. So I hear you guys talking about different types of socialism, but I haven't heard anybody mention anything about, like, eco-socialism or eco-Marxism. And all that kind of plays into this mix.
All right. What do you feel about it?
Well, I'm like, do you guys know about it?
I'm definitely familiar with the concept. A critique of Marx, that Marx believed that, like other classical economists of his time, in infinite abundance and ecological views take into account that we need to devise a socialism that recognizes that there are limits to what the earth can take. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, like, you know, the capitalization of nature and how distribution of ownership in society, like, affects our access to nature and raw materials so that nature becomes class-linked, that capitalism produces adverse ecological conditions because of how it's organizing production, which then threatens its stability and the stability of nature, and then that, like, science and technology are also tools of capitalism whereby we oversimplify nature and we're overconfident in our ability to solve environmental problems. like thinking about how science and tech are driven by money, by profit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard somebody say earlier that like the first to be enslaved were women, but like so
we don't know, but probably.
Right, but that's like, you know, I could see how there'd be an argument for that. But like you bring in eco-Marxism and or eco-socialism, and really like the first to be enslaved was nature. You know, we like enslaved animals to be food for us or to be companions or to do work for us. We've enslaved rivers in how they are tracked, like, you know, with dams and rerouting and... you know, like we've enslaved mountains by blowing up their tops and tunneling through them.
All right, we're getting to the top, so I'm going to have Nathaniel respond. But thank you very much for those thoughts. That's actually very helpful to the discussion. I'm going to give Nathaniel a chance to respond.
Right on. Thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah, definitely. Eco-socialism is definitely something that has been talked about a lot within some socialist movements. Eco-socialism, from what I understand, and I do know that the Green Party practices like eco-socialism, is the fact that eco-socialism is inherently an indigenous knowledge aspect in which you treat the earth like it's your mother, and that you tend to the land like you would tend to like anything else. And so definitely eco-socialism can definitely be tied to the environment and like indigenous populations, and can definitely be, if you work to advance that, the aspect of eco-socialism, you can definitely take on the aspect of like how socialism can be applied to like the human environment, because you also got to take into consideration that the environment as well as like humans are essentially inseparable. And so there's a lot in terms of that aspect. You can look at it through like the lens of environmental racism, in which certain chemicals or like other products are excreted within a certain area that may be located where a poor family may live. Mm-hmm. And definitely you need to take that into consideration, especially considering that there's a lot to take into account.
Has the Party for Socialism and Liberation integrated that in? Because there has been resistance in socialist movements before, saying, well, one of the things that my communist grandfather told my father was, mm-hmm. ecology is a bourgeois science. It's about quality of life, mm-hmm. and we have to protect the workers first, make sure they have their jobs, and then we can worry about the environment. But, that was also at a time when we weren't having as many environmental crises. So I don't know how popular that argument would be anymore. But is your organization working on that?
We're definitely in a study period right now around that specific topic. I do know that in the past, when as a part of our socialist movement, we have been involved within climate marches. I know that the SF branch in San Francisco for the Party for Socialism and Liberation was involved in a climate march in Oakland. And mm-hmm. so they were able to tie like the social issues to climate change. And it definitely can be worked to advance within the future, especially considering the fact that we can like analyze AOC's Green New Deal.
All right, listen, we're getting down to 1 minute left. Is there something, do you have any events coming up or any, if people want to get involved in anything you're doing, do you have any contact information to provide?
Yeah, so if anyone wants to get involved with the local with the Party for Socialism Liberation up here or get involved with like any anti-war movement struggles up here, you can email me, Nathaniel McGuigan, at NAM449@humboldt.edu.
All right. And if they want to involve themselves with Metcha as well, that would be a good way mm-hmm. to reach you.
Of course.
All right. Thank you, Nathaniel McGuigan. I really appreciate you coming in to talk to us. And I'm looking for millennials to talk to of different points of view. And so we will have you next time. Thank you, Michael, for engineering tonight. And thank you for some really thoughtful calls tonight. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Eric Kirk, and to our guest, Nathaniel McGuigan. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email thursdaynighttalk@khsu.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name's Michael. I've been your producer this evening. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is coming up next. It's 8 o'clock.